Hello and welcome to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and today we are talking to Sir Andrew Lickerman, the Dean of London Business School, one of the top business schools in the world with campuses in London and Dubai. Sir Andrew, welcome to Eye on Careers.
Thanks very much, Shane. Very pleased to be here.
It's always interesting, you know, when you see someone who's risen really to the top of their profession, as you have, not just being a dean, but being a dean of one of the top schools. I always wonder what it was like in the early days. You know, were in the sandbox, were you a natural leader? You know, I hope in grade school you were good in your coursework, or what were the early days like for you?
Well, I didn't have the idea that I'd become a dean of a business school, I confess, because business schools were only just starting in the UK when I was starting my career. I knew I wanted to be in industry and commerce. That was seemed to me the exciting place to be. And so that's where I went first of all. After that, I moved into academic life. Then I moved back into industry. Then I moved into academic life again. Then I went to work for the government. So I've been around.
But you're an accountant by profession?
I am. And after I left university, it seemed to me that it was a good thing to become an accountant, because that gave me a skill which was transferable in many different fields. And that's exactly how it's proved. So I absolutely don't regret at all becoming an accountant. It's been a great attribute in my life.
Do you, recommend that that's probably one of the pillars of, you know, a business professional is understanding accounting? And for those CEOs, for example, who don't have the accounting background, they can almost be held hostage by their CFO.
That is true. But I think by the time somebody reaches the CEO stage, they've realized that they need to know something about the money, and they can't simply rely on a good CFO to tell them what to do. So at the London Business School, we've got a lot of people, for example, who are rising through the ranks and heading towards being CEOs, who come along to make sure they can understand more about the numbers so that they can do what's necessary.
And get the quality of decision making where it needs to be. So after university, you went and did your accounting qualification, or before?
Yeah, no, I went straight from university into industry, and I became a management accountant. So I was dealing, I had the advantage for 3 years of working for an organization. It was a manufacturing, a textile organization. And I took my qualification at the same time. And so I kind of was efficient in that way in getting a qualification and getting some experience as well.
So it was long days and even longer nights then, as you burned the midnight oil over the study books.
Yeah, and I kind of, that's the right moment to do it. Unmarried, early 20s is a good moment to be spending most of your night studying.
So then after the textile plant, then what happened? Where did you move from there?
Well, I was approached to go into academic life, and I thought to myself, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, so I thought it'd be an interesting thing to do. Now, actually, probably subconsciously, I found this attractive, and so I had my first spell in academic life in my late 20s, and I did find that I liked it.
So you went back to school to do your MBA, is that?
No, I became an academic at Leeds University in the UK. And so I taught the financial stuff that I'd just already learned.
Okay, and so you were basically a professor at Leeds University?
I was indeed, yes.
Okay, and so how long did that go on for?
Well, it went on for a couple of years, and then I was asked, this was a family business, my family asked me to come in and help on the family business. And I felt duty bound to do it because they needed the help at that time.
So what was the family business?
It was a textile business in the UK. And I, as part of that, I went to run a textile plant in Germany, which was very exciting, but also pretty troubling, because we actually had to shut the plant. And shutting a manufacturing plant in Germany is quite a tough thing to do. So that was very much a baptism of fire in terms of early experience.
Did you have any rioting, or, you know, were you able to avoid that?
No, but there was a lot of, understandably, there was a lot of bad blood, and I had to get permission to do it, because in Germany that's what you have to do. You have to negotiate with the trade unions and so on. So I got, that was fantastic experience in a sense, but of course experience I'd much rather not have had, but it was definitely, it was a really tough thing to do.
And so then you move on back into academia. What happens after that?
Yes, we sold the family business, and I decided that I would like to go back into academic life because I found I really enjoyed it. And so I went back to lecturing, first to Leeds and then to the London Business School.
Okay, and so you were a professor at London Business School.
I was indeed, and you know, very much enjoyed that. But then, if you want the next stage of the story, I was approached to go and work for the government, and I'd never been involved in this at all, but it was a very, very exciting assignment, a group of people advising the UK cabinet on policy. And I thought to myself, look, I don't know what this is all about, but this looks too exciting to pass up. I'll spend the rest of my life regretting if I don't do it. So I did, and I went to work for them for 3 years.
And then you came back?
Then I went back to London Business School and was there for 14 years.
Where you are to this day?
Yes. No, well, I went off there. I went back to the government again. I worked for 11 years for the Treasury, for the Finance Ministry in the UK. And I did that because I had a huge assignment to do, moving the whole of the UK finances from a cash basis to an accrual basis, which was a big project.
Right. Okay. And then you come back.
Then I went back to London Business School again. So, I mean, just taking the theme of, is it a good idea to get a qualification? That finance qualification enabled me to move from industry and commerce into academic life and then into government and so on and roundabout. So I'm really grateful I did it.
So when what point did you become the dean?
I became the dean in 2009, and I hadn't anticipated becoming the dean. I hadn't wished to do it because I went back from the Treasury to the London Business School to work on the measurement of performance. This is an area that is fascinating to me because it is really difficult to do, and everybody wants to try and get a better idea of what success means, but find it very difficult to measure. And so I spent 5 years working on the issues of measuring things that are very difficult to measure in terms of success.
So you're talking about the performance of the professors, of the academic program?
No, of absolutely everything. That's to say, I worked on, you can imagine, to all, think of almost any area of performance measurement, conventionally things like, is the organization successful? And then are individuals successful? Then I worked out things like, are board successful? Is the human resources function successful? And so on. But all the way then I worked on, for example, things like, what about the success of the Allied intervention in Afghanistan for the BBC? So I worked on a framework for performance measurement that could tell people, you know, whether they were being successful, and if they weren't, what they needed to do to find out.
I think it's a much-needed framework here in the Middle East. I'm sure you would have quite an audience for that. And so then by default, so how does that transcend into becoming the dean for anyone out there who wants to become a dean?
Well, you know, so I didn't want to become a dean. My colleagues asked me to be a dean, and so I said yes, because having worked for so long in the institution and feeling very committed to it, I felt that I wanted to do that. And I found it is a very challenging role because academic administration is particularly tough. There are a lot of different stakeholders. It's more complex in many ways than running a commercial organization or indeed being part of government.
So when you look back at London Business School, I mean, today it's obviously ranked in the top 10 consistently. But back in the day, you know, when it started, it was not much of a business school.
Well, I mean, we're very proud of the fact that this year we're celebrating our 50th birthday. And in the early days in the UK, and indeed, you know, for much of the world outside the US, business schools hardly existed. People didn't know what they should be, how you'd know they were any good, and so on. And for the first few years, we basically made our mark. Now, we were set up as a centre of excellence in the UK, so we knew we had to be good from the very start. But still, other people didn't necessarily know we were any good. It's only in the last 20 years with rankings that people have been able to make judgments. Now, going back to my field of performance measurement, I can tell you now, rankings are not the final story about how good a business school is. But they do help to give a sense of perspective on how different factors vary between one business school and another. And that is very helpful, obviously, for those who want to decide, do I go to business school or not, and which business school should I choose?
That journey of, you know, rising to excellence, you know, whether it's London Business School, it's yourself, or it's your career, that's kind of a journey that must be wrought full of failures and victories, peaks and valleys. What were some of the big challenges as you built up this business school into a globally competitive institution?
Well, compared to the U.S. business schools outside the U.S. don't have the kind of financial resources which are available to the major U.S. schools. I mean, they have had 100 more years of fundraising and a tradition whereby the alumni support the business school. In Europe, especially, business schools were started out as part of the university system, supported by the government. Now, governments progressively have withdrawn funding from business schools, leaving fees as the primary means of finance. But fees alone are not enough to sustain a world-class business school. And so we have started on a major fundraising campaign in order to make sure that we can deploy the kinds of resources and give the kinds of experience that the major US schools have long been used to giving. The great credit, and it's not me, it's my predecessors I would give particular credit to, is that they created a very fine institution up there with the best business schools in the world, ranked by others, not by us, without those kinds of resources. My concern and my interest is to make sure we have the resources to make sure we maintain ourselves as one of the world's top business schools.
I think when I looked at the statistics, 76 universities in the United States have $1 billion plus endowment. And in the UK, from what I understand, you probably know this better than me, I believe there's only one.
There may be two. It probably just Oxford and Cambridge. Now, their universities have been going for 800 years, so they've had a lot of time to build up the resources. But generally speaking, in the UK, and as I say, in not just in Europe, but generally outside the US, there hasn't been that kind of tradition.
This is the story of Sir Andrew Lickerman, the dean of one of the biggest, one of the top business schools in the world, London Business School, sharing his secrets to the road to the top.
Dubai Eye 103.8. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're listening to the story of Sir Andrew Lickerman, the dean of London Business School, one of the top business schools in the world. Welcome back to Eye on Careers, Sir Andrew.
Thanks, Shane.
So we were just talking about some of the challenges. For those just joining us, London Business School is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And actually, when the school started, not only was it a bit challenged to get international fame that it has today, but I think business schools in general were extremely unpopular. So we just kind of talked about some of the challenges there. But and as you pointed out, that there's probably one or two endowments, educational endowments, over $1 billion in the United Kingdom versus the United States that has 76 billion dollar plus educational endowments. So the tables are slightly weighted to the Americans on this, and it's very difficult to build a challenging to build a world-class institution without the funding. So basically what I was saying is that it doesn't matter whether you are a educational institution or on a microcosm level, this the individual who still needs that money to invest in their infrastructure. You don't have money to take the London Business School tuition. You can't build your career or take the extra training. Or maybe you're a small business that can invest. You need to open up five more stores, but you need the revenue to open the stores, and you can't open the stores to get the revenue, but you can't get the revenue to open the stores, if anyone follows what I was saying there. But these are kind of typical business challenges. I know you've also had your own business.
Yeah, one of the things I did in my life was to start my own business, and that was a fantastic opportunity. I mean, there's nothing quite like I found sitting in a room by myself with a telephone and a desk, and that's it. And the huge advantage of that, of course, is that meetings are great. You have a meeting with yourself, you make decisions very, very quickly, your budget and plan takes about 10 minutes, while you jot down a few notes. All of us who have sat through really boring meetings hour after hour, I'm sure will warm to the notion that you can do it all in a few minutes. Nevertheless, I know that starting a small business is really tough. I mean, all the kinds of decisions you have to take. You have to build a thing from scratch. You have to have a strategy. You've got to have financing. You've got to have deliveries, production, sales. All those kinds of things have got to be embodied often in one or just a few people. And it's no wonder, therefore, that many small businesses fail, because at that stage, you need so many skills to make it work. And if anything goes disastrously wrong, then the business is likely to fail, as as we know many small businesses do. So I've got a huge admiration for those who start their own small business and get them to take off and get them to, you know, build their businesses into something really substantial.
And in a sense, I like Andy Grove, the founder, co-founder of Intel, when he said, you know, you are like a small business. You have to own your career like an entrepreneur owns their SME. You know, you need to develop yourself. No one owes you anything. No one's going to give you a free handout. You know, you have to go out there and develop yourself, invest in yourself and build it up just like you would build your own business. Are there a lot of parallels there between the development of an SME and the development of the professional themselves?
Yeah, I think there are, because in a sense, if you take your own career very much as if it was a small business, if it was a project, you know, you should be taking as much care on that and thinking about what makes it a success, what are the barriers in the way, what am I going to do about it, how am I going to plan for the short term and the long term. So I think it's very much a question of taking one's own career in hand. Now, obviously, everything is not in your own control. So for me, that kind of planning also means having the opportunity to say, wait a minute, here's a chance that's coming along, and do I take that or not? Does that fit into the framework? It's a combination, inevitably, of planning things out, but also taking opportunities when they arise. And that combination, it seems to me, in most cases, is what constitutes a great business plan for oneself.
As people kind of move forward now in strategy, you know, the MBA, you know, when you look back, say, for example, if we went back to the 80s and 90s here in Dubai, if you had an MBA, you know, you command a premium and, you know, you're trading at a premium. Today, if you have an MBA, it's not necessarily going to give you that same premium. You need to do other things. And I think when people look at themselves, they don't like to think of themselves as a brand, as a product, as a service, as almost a commodity. As we move into the 21st century, talent can be a commodity. And so how do you trade that commodity at a premium? I think this is kind of one of the fundamental questions executives need to ask themselves.
Well, I entirely agree, because what you've got to do in thinking about developing yourself is, first of all, what are the skills I need and what's the best way of getting hold of that? And in my experience, the factor that's most likely for a course or a program to be successful is the person taking it matching what they want with the program. Too many people in my experience go into a program in some vague idea of what they want to achieve. If you define closely what you want to achieve, you're much more likely to find the right program for you. Having said that, you then want to have a label which you can show demonstrates the quality of who you are. In terms of saying all MBAs are the same, all MBAs are not the same. You know, there are a lot of MBAs around, and we're very proud of the fact that we are a premium product. That means we've got to be very careful who we bring in to make sure we maintain the value of the brand. But so I would advise two things if you're thinking about developing yourself. First of all, define closely what it is you want. Make sure it's the right program for you, whatever that is. And secondly, make sure you go somewhere which gives you a label which you'll then be proud of.
Don't you think that, you know, whether you're dealing with the accounting profession or you're dealing with your MBA, that the people are there more for the qualification, you know, stamp than the actual knowledge and skill set? And the thing that actually is going to allow you to trade at a premium is the skill set that's driving the result. And so it's not necessarily, do you think that people are too focused on getting that stamp? I have my MBA, now give me a job.
Look, people vary. Some people simply want the stamp. Other people are not interested in the stamp. They simply want the knowledge. My view would be both are important. But fundamentally, if you're going to undertake something really serious in terms of an educational qualification, then you do need to want the skills themselves. Otherwise, you're going to be spending a lot of time doing things that are not enjoyable and not interesting, and it's all going to be a big drag. So, you know, since life is short, I believe that one's learning should be enjoyable just as much as everything else. And so I think it's really important to get the right fit between you and the program.
as we kind of move forward into the 21st century, we're, you know, and that's what I was talking about earlier, is that the positioning of an executive as a chartered accountant, as an MBA, or whatever other qualification you want to get, that market equity slowly erodes over time as more and more people get the same positioning. So then as the next stage, you know, a lot of people are saying that now you need to be the niche specialist, or, you know, as the future of work continues and we globalize and virtual offices continue to prosper, that the ability to get a specialist in any field takes less than an hour or 2 hours from not. So what's your take on, you know, what kind of skill sets and how should people be thinking about their careers in the future? Do they need to be specialists, or will the general manager continue to live on?
Well, you know, it's a cliche to say that, you know, we live in a changing world. The kinds of issues that we're facing today will not be the same issues as we face in 2030. And one's got to be adaptable to the circumstances around one. But in terms of learning, my assumption is that we're all in a process. We've got to be in a process of lifelong learning. The kinds of things that you're required to do today, a lot of them simply didn't exist 20 years ago. And the idea that you could kind of stop learning age 20 or 30 or 40 is long gone. So what I think you've got to do is to say to yourself, what are the skills I need now, thinking about the immediate future, but also about the long term. But I think one's got to keep an open mind to understand what's happening in the world and adapt to take whatever additional qualifications one needs. Can I just give you one example? Last year we had an American surgeon came and take a one-year course at the London Business School. We have a program, the Sloan Program, in London. Now, he was age 60. And you might think, in traditional times, age 60, well, you kind of retire age 60. He said, I'm not going to retire. I have got a whole phase of my working life ahead of me, and I've been a surgeon. I'm now going to do other things after 60. Now, you could say, my goodness, that's a bit ambitious, isn't it? But if you look at the longevity tables, the fact is, we are living much longer than we were. A lot of people don't want to retire when their fathers and grandfathers retired. And it seems that's a very good example of saying we've got to make sure that we keep an open mind on learning and link it to the pattern of our own lives.
It's one interesting trend, in fact, that, you know, a lot of people don't want to retire in their 60s, 65s. I think there was one Japanese professor who's 114 and he's still teaching courses or something. So, you know, one of the trends you're seeing is that you may go to work, you know, get your first degree, work for 8 years, come back, do your MBA, and then 20 or 30 years later, you may do a top up with a Sloan program or another executive education. This is a growth area for you.
I agree. And it doesn't have to be a degree program. It doesn't have to be a long program. I mean, my assumption is, and we offer a large number of programs, a lot of schools offer a lot of programs, 1 week, 2 week, 4 week programs, which are right for people at certain stages in their career. It may be a top up, it may be people changing careers, changing jobs, changing positions within the organization, moving up from one level to another. So coming back to the theme, as it were, it's about lifelong learning to me, and not just a one-off, an injection in one's late 20s as an MBA, and that's really the end of the story. It can't be that.
And I think, you know, what you're, you know, for me, the message there is it's not what you get out of it. It's who you become. And when you describe that story of the surgeon, you know, he's more interested in becoming a business-minded person. He really doesn't care at the end of the day when he gets his Sloan degree. I'm sure he, you know, he's proud of it. But he's not there for the Sloan degree. He's there for the knowledge to become a business professional.
Absolutely. And changing one's life, you know, changing the way one lives one life and what one's going to do is surely going to be more and more frequent. You know, the idea of a lifelong career in the same kind of industry or the same organization was fine, you know, 50 years ago. It isn't fine now. And, you know, the patterns of work are changing to such a degree that I'm sure this will be the norm in the future.
This is Sir Andrew Liquorman giving you his insights to the future of the workplace and the value of education as we progress in the 21st century. We're going to hear more from Sir Andrew in just a moment.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we're talking with Sir Andrew Lickerman, the Dean of London Business School, one of the top business schools in the world. Sir Andrew, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you, Shane.
It's a pleasure having you here. And I think for those just joining us, we've talked a little bit about the challenge of building a world-class business school up from basically from nothing. You see your 50th anniversary, and that's young by many measures within your industry. And then we also talked about some of the strategies people can look at for developing themselves and managing their careers effectively in the 21st century. Now I think, you know, as a business school, I think, you know, looking at leadership, strategy, operations, these are kind of the staples of your coursework. But, you know, when you look at it, when you look at, say, a top leader, a top CEO, you know, one of the things, in my humble opinion, is, you know, their ability to create ownership of a strategy, to get their frontline staff to actually feel as if that idea or that strategy is theirs. Do you feel that, you know, this is an area that separates the men from the boys, or the professionals from the not so professional? I guess that was a pretty sexist way to describe it, but you know what I mean.
But I think I know what you mean, Shane. No, I do agree with you. One of my colleagues, Rob Goffey, wrote a book which had the title "Why Should Anybody Be Led by You?" which I think is a question that every leader needs to ask themselves. Because to be a leader, you need to justify your leadership role. And you need to show people, to demonstrate to people, what it is exactly they're following. So for me, an essential element of leadership is ensuring that those who work for the organization understand what they're supposed to be doing, the context of their work, and the reason why, to be blunt, they should get up in the morning and come to work. Now, it seems to me an organization where people have a very clear idea about that feels very different and is much more likely to succeed than one where people have not much idea what's going on, not much idea what their role is, and indeed no idea really where the organization's going.
And, you know, I like how you said the reason why, which also speaks to a sense of value and the sense of value in profession. I think, you know, whether in education and healthcare, you inherently get that value. But when you saw, for example, in the financial crisis, it seemed like the bankers had lost sense of their value. And in fact, when they were attacked, they just turtled and they didn't even stand up for their own profession, which at the end of the day, in my humble opinion, is the bedrock of freedom. Your ability to give access to capital to people is the key to freedom. It allows them to chase their livelihood, chase their dreams. And they seem to have completely lost sight of what the value of the profession is, and the leadership just collapsed.
Well, I think in the financial services industry, you had a very particular culture which was linked absolutely to money. In other words, the people were there for the very large bonuses which were being paid. And this is a dilemma, because in most organizations, that doesn't apply. One doesn't have huge bonuses of that kind. So in one sense, I think you can regard financial services being a bit special. But if the implication there is that people are not necessarily motivated only by money, I would agree. My experience is that people want to have a sense of meaning to what they do. They want to have a sense of purpose in their lives. And since work takes such a large proportion of our lives, it makes good sense to feel that you're doing something that is worthwhile in its own right. Now, of course, people want to be well paid, and the evidence is that pay does play a role. But one's got to split that out. Having enough pay is pretty crucial. If people feel they are underpaid for what they do, that is a big minus. And particularly when people feel they're unfairly treated compared to others in the organization, that gives rise to a lot of aggravation. But if you can get people who feel they are being adequately paid, they're being properly paid in relation to the other people in the organization, after that, it may well be a question of saying, all right, so let's try and make sure people understand what it is they're doing and motivate them in terms of the content and worth of their jobs.
Do you think as well that this sense of value is almost, I think, taught to them as they grow up? Because when you're in high school or you're in university, they're teaching you how to get a job. They're not teaching you how to create a life's work. And those individuals who, you know, have a huge value for what they do, they're creating a life's work. You know, is that part of the problem, is that people are just coming and doing the bare minimum they have to do their job, the bare minimum from keeping them from getting fired at the end of the day?
In part, this is a matter of culture, and I think there are very different ways of looking at work all the way through the world. I'm under no illusion that somehow, because things apply in one country, it necessarily applies in another. Having said that, though, there are some pretty common aspects, it seems to me, about the way in which you can help people to motivate people, to make them really give to the organization. What is fascinating, if you look at the way that people talk about their work and whether they have any commitment to it and feel passion for it, that matters a huge amount, particularly for organizations that deal with customers, where customer service is relevant. Now, we've all been to organizations where you know that the person serving you doesn't give, you know, just doesn't care about the organization, and they demonstrate that to you in the way in which they treat you. And similarly to others, where you feel valued as a customer, and the person serving you clearly feels that they have an obligation to commit the organization to what it's doing. So I do think there's a big role here in managing well the expectations of people in terms of them coming to the organization and really giving of their best. And I think, sorry if I sound a bit sort of theological about this, but I feel that management has a responsibility to give people good working lives. Fact is, if people are going to spend a lot of their time and, you know, devote their lives to an organization, senior management has a not just a role but an obligation to make sure that people can get the most out of their lives. You know, I've seen people with wasted lives working with organizations which are badly run, and I feel it's terrible. It's just such a waste.
When you talk about kind of, you know, this, in a sense, it's motivation. You know, they're in a company that is not motivating them, or that, but they're fearful to leave. You know, what's the leader's job regarding motivation? Should leaders be required to motivate people, or is it, you know, one perspective is good people don't need to be motivated. If you need to be motivating people, you need to get rid of them. I mean, where does this sit, and how does this plug into creating a high-performance culture?
Well, I think that, you know, we're all human beings, and I've yet to find human beings who didn't want to be respected as individuals, no matter what the culture is. That is pretty universal. Nobody can sort of generate the enthusiasm from nothing to decide this is a wonderful thing to do. You do need to be motivated, and it seems to me that is an absolutely essential element of what leadership is about. So, you know, I've got no doubt about this as an essential element of leadership.
That motivating is part of it.
Absolutely.
And one of the CEOs I talked to, he said, listen, Shane, you know, our job is not to motivate people. He said, people want to do well in their jobs. The main issue is not demotivating people. And we've all been in those morning meetings where any ambition or drive you had for the company went out the window 10 minutes into that, as soon as that guy or lady starts talking, right?
Well, I find not demotivating a pretty low threshold. You know, for me, you know, motivating people, as I say, is not just important for the organization, because you want people who feel committed to what they do. It, at the margin, it really matters. That little bit of extra effort, the smile, the whatever it is that makes a big difference. And to me, I'm chief executive of an organization, the London Business School, and for me, it really matters that people should feel committed to it. And I get regular feedback in terms of, we have surveys, and people say whether they're motivated or not. And it matters to me to feel that they are.
Well, part of motivation, people would argue, is incentives. And I almost just think it's crazy that the incentive programs that we're using today are, you know, 2,000, 3,000, debatably much older than that, in terms of here's your base pay and here's your incentive. And then now we have interesting data where you have things like Wikipedia, where you have professionals working for free. You have Apache, which was the world's dominant HTTP server that's created for free by professionals. Linux, the same thing. So we are getting example after example of people being motivated to who are qualified professionals to do great work for free. So it really drives home a spear to the heart of our Comp and Bend programs and almost asks, are we totally missing the point in how to deal with the human factor of our business?
It does matter. People, how much people earn obviously matters. They want to be able to pay their bills. They want to do with the basics to keep their families, whatever it is. So I'm not discounting pay altogether. And also I recognize that in certain industries and certain professions, there is a level of pay where if somebody does not get that level of pay, they will feel demotivated, but they will say, well, all the other people doing this have got such pay, so why can't I? And it's that comparative factor that I lay particular stress on as being a potentially big demotivator. Having said that, there are some professions, there are some jobs where money is a very important component. And certain people who want to earn very high salaries understandably gravitate more towards those jobs. And if they're able to do a fantastic job in order to earn that kind of money, I don't feel that's an issue, you know. But very clearly, it's a bargain struck between the employer and the employee that is the primary focus. But I think your point about saying, is this the only thing that motivates? I am convinced it is not.
This is Sir Andrew Lickerman, the Dean of London Business School, giving his philosophies and insights into how to successfully manage your career and your business. More from him in just a minute, so stay with us.
Dubai i103.8, content that keeps you listening. Stay one step ahead.
Hello and welcome back to Eye on Careers. I'm your host, Shane Phillips, and we are here with Sir Andrew Lickerman, the Dean of London Business School, one of the world's top business schools that has traditionally ranked in the top 10 from the FT ranking since 2001. For the last 4 years, it's been ranked in the top 5, and it's also the first non-US business school to rank number 1 on the FT rankings. Sir Andrew, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you very much. Shame.
It's been quite interesting. For those just joining us, Andrew talked about his own development as well as the development of London Business School from its nascent start in the 60s, where business schools weren't even popular, to one of the top schools in the world. And he also looked at what you really need to be successful in your career or as a business leader, touching on some key things such as employee ownership, strategy, motivation, and so on. You can catch all of this if you missed it on our website on dubaii1038.com/eye on careers. So, Sir Andrew, I mean, you've really had an exciting career that's kind of threaded its way through the private sector, the public sector, and you've even run your own businesses, started your own businesses. So you threw a little entrepreneurial splash into the mix there as well. Do you have any success mantras or North Stars that kind of guide you through the darkness on your toughest moments?
Well, this is difficult because, you know, we're all such individuals in a sense. You know, what's good for me may not be good for everybody else. But just three things that strike me in terms of advice I might give anybody thinking about their career and what they should do. The first thing is that in terms of you as an individual, it seems to me that one has to realize that you're going to learn an awful lot from other people, both as individuals and perhaps through such institutions as the London Business School and others, which help you in your career. So the first piece of advice I would give is to make sure you're listening to what's going on around you. A lot of people spend their time talking a lot and not listening very much. You're going to get an awful lot from other people, and when you're listening to something which is really valuable, that is really valuable to you. And so I would counsel, you know, listening perhaps rather than talking as the first way to set about this. The second thing is to be flexible. You live in a world, we all live in a world, which moves along very fast, and the kinds of skills we have today may not be useful in 20 and 30 years' time. You've got to keep on thinking about how you change things. And being flexible, being open to opportunities, seems to me a really critical part of any career path. You know, you can try and plan as much as you like, but some things will come along through luck or whatever it is, and you need to have the mindset which says, here's something unexpected, I'm going to take an opportunity. The third thing, and that seems to me pretty universal, is that when you deal with other people, you've got to respect them as individuals. Nobody likes being treated badly. Nobody likes being taken for granted. Nobody likes being ignored. I've yet to find people in my working life who have liked being ignored and being treated badly. And it strikes me that a lot of people who, you know, as soon as they get into any kind of leadership position, start, like, telling people what to do, bossing them about. I mean, it's silly. Because actually, if you want to lead people, you want to get their collaboration, you want them to work with you. So my strong advice is, as pretty universal, which is to respect the people you work with, and that includes the people working for you.
I once read that they said, if you want to be a good leader, you should spend 50% of your time leading yourself, first of all. And I don't know how close that hits home with you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what quite in this context what leading yourself means, but if it means, for example, reflecting and understanding what it means to be a good leader and not just, you know, doing things on a whim, I'd absolutely agree with that.
I think going back to your listening, I mean, people underestimate how powerful it is. In fact, a lot of conflicts can simply de-escalate immediately just by listening. And often, even if you're a customer, you don't actually want a refund, or you don't actually want, you just want them to listen to your complaint, and then you're okay, and you go on, right?
You're absolutely right. If you take complaints, I mean, people complain to me about all sorts of things. It seems to me, again, the least you can do is to give them the respect as individuals to say, I've listened to you, you know, I've heard what you've said. It may be that you can't do anything about it, but simply to brush these things aside and, you know, for people to feel they're being ignored, of course, immediately escalates the whole issue. Similarly, if I think about listening more generally, you know, you can pick up, if you really listen to people, you can pick up what is that's going on. If you're immediately framing a response as soon as somebody started talking to you, you're not listening anymore. So, I mean, that's why I place such stress on listening.
It's quite funny, too, because, you know, even if you think of your own voice, you know, when you play back, you know, in radio, when you play back your own voice, it sounds different. So even the fact that you think you're listening to what you're saying, you don't even know what your own voice sounds like. And when you talk with so many business leaders, they're so focused on what the message is that they're giving versus how that message is actually being received. So you could even be, you know, thinking you're saying X, and they're hearing Y, and they're hearing it in a very different context because you, in fact, don't even know what your own voice sounds like.
We pick up a lot of signals from other people in terms of whether we believe they're sincere, whether we believe they're telling the truth, you know, and what it is exactly they're trying to tell us. I mean, we're pretty sophisticated animals in general, and I'm astonished sometimes to find people talking as if what they're saying is enough to convince an audience or convince the person they're talking to. We do need to think about how we say things, because how we say things matters just as much as what we say.
Then the next point you mentioned is agility is quite an it's quite a complicated piece, because on one hand, you know, the leader has a certain rigidity about them. That's why they're the leader. You know, Christopher Columbus wasn't like, let's go to the New World. No, turn back. No, let's go to the New World. No, forget. Okay, we're going. No, we're not. Let's do it. You know, at a certain point, that rigidity, that stubbornness is the bedrock of their success. You know, Gandhi refused to eat if he couldn't eat vegetarian. I mean, you know, he was stubborn. That was one of his biggest traits, and that and you know, he was willing to die for what he believed in. That's how stubborn this guy was. You know, at what point do you know that, yeah, you know, this is something, you know, I need to push forward, and, you know, this is something I really need to let go? That is a very tough dilemma, especially for the entrepreneur, for the heavyweight CEO or you know, heavyweight leader.
We spend all our time juggling the general principles we're trying to follow with responding to the specifics of the situation. And leaders are no different in that respect. They've got to have a clear vision of where the organization is going. And that, hopefully, has been brought about by thinking very carefully about, you know, where the organization ought to be going. Now, within that, there are many different pressures to do different things. And as I say, balancing the general direction with the need to change wherever necessary to the circumstance is one of the most difficult things a leader has to do. Now, it seems to me if a leader at any stage understands and knows that something has gone wrong and the general principles no longer apply, by far the best thing to do is to share that with your followers and to tell people, look, circumstances have changed, we've had to do certain kinds of things, and again, treat them with respect, taking them into the confidence of the leader so they can understand why things have changed. There's nothing worse than being part of an organization which incomprehensibly changes its strategy, doesn't seem to know where it's going, and people respond on the whole pretty badly to that.
And yeah, I think we saw sentiment towards the multinational seems to be dropping incredibly fast due to exactly that. But what would your advice be for individuals kind of in three tiers, if I could put them in three buckets, the early career executive, the mid-career, and then the senior individual who may be your cohort or peer group?
When you're in your 20s, you're starting your career off, you clearly need to get as much as you can by way of experience. And that doesn't mean to say you have to change jobs. Some jobs give you a load of experience within the same job. You also have to get the knowledge you need and the confidence, which is going to enable you to go through your working life. And clearly, one of the ways, well, I would say that, wouldn't I, is to go to a business school. That's one of the things I hope we can contribute to you. But not everybody has to go to business school. So that's very much the learning part and the laying the foundations. Mid-career, this is obviously the time when people are either moving up the ladder or have decided they've not got to the right position and need to make the change. And that kind of position there may be made more difficult because people have got families at that stage, they've got commitments, it's a much more constrained period. And that's the time, it seems to me, when it's almost most difficult to say, what should somebody do? Because we vary so much from individual to individual. But again, going back to my general principles of being adaptable, understanding when opportunities come along, it may be that even in mid-career, you need to think about a change. And finally, towards the end of your career, and nowadays that can extend well past conventional retirement age, I mean, that's a stage when I would have thought people need to think about the satisfaction they're getting from their jobs, what it is they're contributing, how long they want to work, and so on. That should be, in some respects, the easiest part of their lives. They've already got a load of skills. The question then is, how do they want to build on those? How long do they want to work? So, I mean, it's difficult to generalize because we differ so much, and the sort of the crunch points in each of our lives comes differently. But flexibility is crucial, whatever your age.
Well, thank you so much, Sir Andrew. It was a pleasure having you on Eye on Careers. Hopefully we can have you on again sometime. Unfortunately, we're running a bit short on time. But thanks again for coming out.
Great pleasure.
And, of course, we wish you well again with your business school efforts, and we hope you continue to take those accolades away from the Americans. So good luck with that. So that was Sir Andrew Lickerman, from the Dean of the London Business School. And that's it for this episode of Eye on Careers.